research, usually in the last talk of a retreat, is about mentioning, according to the question which was asked last night, that this afternoon, this evening, you'll be going home, or you'll be going back to your monastery, or you'll be going off to another place, another talk, another retreat. That's my life. And actually, what do we do? How do we make use of all of this which we built up on this retreat? And the first thing to point out was, be very careful when you leave this retreat, going out, driving home. Sometimes you don't realize just how cool and quiet you become on a retreat such as this. Because everybody is traveling in the same direction, we haven't got much to compare ourselves with. And sometimes you think, well, you haven't really got it, you haven't got anywhere in this retreat. But I guarantee when you go outside these doors and go into the traffic and go back home with the noise and the restlessness, sometimes that because of your cool, calm, peaceful perspective, it seems to be absolutely madness out there. That's why I encourage some people, just if you get in your car before you drive home, just go up and down the small back streets for a few minutes to accustom yourself to the world again. Otherwise, sometimes it's very hard to respond when somebody tries to cut in front of you, or when the red light suddenly changes and you have to put your foot on the brake very quickly. Sometimes instead of putting the foot on the brake, just say, let go, let go, let go, no control. So please look after yourself. Allow yourself time to get yourself back into the world mode again. Remember the first time I went on a retreat, it's actually in a quasi-Tibetan monastery in the north of the south of Scotland, many, many years ago. And I was just meditating and doing my thing, but everyone else in that place was doing the same. So I never really noticed anything until I left and went back to London. And it was just really shocking just how noisy people were and how frantic and how fast they spoke and how agitated they moved. And I didn't realize that I'd slowed down. No, 1 week prior to that, I was exactly the same. So what's one of the first things you'll recognize when you go out into the world, you'll have something to compare yourself with. And I guarantee you'll find that you have changed enormously, much more than you expect. So be gentle. But when you go back home, it's so easy to actually to throw away all the peace, all the tranquility, and all the wisdom which you gain on a retreat such as this. It's such a shame that these wonderful qualities such as stillness, silence, peace, inner contentment, freedom, and we have these that sometimes because we take them for granted, we think they're always going to be there once we've developed them, but we don't actually keep them, we don't guard them. And it needs to be brought to mind of the four right efforts. In my mind, the fourth effort, right effort, is perhaps the most important, as if the Buddha left the best to last. And that fourth right effort was that the meditator strives, puts forth energy, applies the mind to keep and develop, to maintain and help grow any wholesome, skillful dhammas which arise in the mind. You look after them, you maintain them, so they can grow. Sometimes we do all the work to keep out the bad stuff. We do all the work to cultivate and bring up good stuff, and as soon as it's there, we get heedless and allow it to disappear. Goodness, because of the laws of impermanence, suffering and non-self, because of the defilements in the world, goodness is a very fragile plant which does need to be nurtured and kept safe. Otherwise, with just the winds and the destructive forces of the world, it can too easily get damaged, get hurt, and get killed. And you know that with things like peace and kindness, and with love, with freedom in the world. It's so easy for it to get lost because we are heedless. Which is why the Buddha always said, or I said especially the last words of advice, be heedless. Be sorry. Sorry, I forgot what he said. Please cut that out of the tape. But otherwise people, they quote you. Ajahn Brahm said, the Buddha said, be heedless. And I get in big trouble. He said, don't be heedless. And be healers, be careful. And guard the good states, the kind states, the lovely states which you've developed. So when you do go out of here, see if you can guard this like a very precious jewel someone has given you. And it is very precious, because each one of you, no matter how deep you've got in your meditation, at least you've got somewhere. I guarantee that. I know that. And where you've got is a state of peace, a state of freedom, at least a taste of freedom. Even though that taste of freedom might be the light at the end of a long tunnel, but then, you know, you've got close to it than you normally have, and you've seen it. Yeah, there is such a thing as freedom, there's such a thing as peace, there's such a thing as contentment, and that's where happiness truly lies. And so, if you cultivate, or rather you keep and maintain as long as possible, that peace, that freedom, that sort of wisdom inside the heart, it will look after you in the lay life. In the lay life, it's as if that you go out there and you work very hard and you do all of your chores and all your duties. You always got a place to go home to. But as Ajahn Chah said, our inner home, our true home, our real home. And your home is not sort of the house in which you live in, or the kuti in which you stay in if you're a monk or an anagarika. Your true home is inside of yourself. And you can see that in your meditation. And sometimes you sit here and you go inside and you're as happy as can be. We don't want anything. You can really rest and relax and feel comfort. And that's what a home is supposed to be. A place of comfort. A place where you can relax. A place where you can let go. Where you don't have to struggle with the world. Where there's nothing asked of you or demanded of you. Where you can just really relax and be at peace. That's what we build our homes for. Unfortunately, many homes are places of strife and struggle, of work, even turmoil. It's not a real home. But you can understand inside of your minds what we mean by the ideal home, the real home, the refuge inside of us, the refuge of the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, which we take deep inside of ourselves. A refuge means a place of peace, a place of freedom from danger, a place of security. A place where there's no measuring anymore. Where you can just be yourself, be at peace, be at ease, be nothing, empty, free. And the purpose of this meditation is sometimes to get you in touch with your real home. The place of stillness inside of you. And you realize that that home is, as it were, carried around with you all the time. And by carrying that home around with you all the time, inside of yourself, once you know the door, how to get in there, the door of my heart's open to me no matter what I ever do. Freedom, love, compassion. Just being still, not controlling, letting go, is the door into that real home inside of you. Not measuring, not judging. Quietness, not thinking. There you come in to the door of your inner home. And if you know that inner home, that place where you can reside in at will at any time, it means when you do go out there into your world and do your jobs, do your business, work hard and strive and struggle for the sake of other beings, do your duties in the family, make merit, look after your family business, your concerns or whatever, when you do all of that, at least you've got a place to come back to, a refuge, a home. It's when we don't have that refuge or home, we don't know how to escape and from the turmoil of life. I've mentioned from the suttas, the Buddha said that you should know the gratification, the danger, and the escape from these things. You can understand the gratification, you can understand the danger of the worldly ways. But please know the escape as well. And I've taught you the escape. I just mentioned it again here. Go into the inner home. So once you know that inner home and feel familiar with it and know the ways in, it means out there in the world you can always go back to the inner home at any time. It's a place of rest, a real refuge of the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. You know, the Buddha, one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. That's not Gautama the Buddha, passed away to Nibbana hundreds of years ago. That's the Dhamma inside your heart, the Buddha inside the heart. That state of freedom, that knowing, that awakening. That liberation, that's the real refuge inside of one. And that's what connects you with all the other Aryas in the world. That's the Arya Sangha inside the heart. That's why it's a refuge, because deep within. And you know why it's a refuge? Because whatever you're doing out there in the world, you can always come back home to put your feet up, as it were, have a cup of tea, and to really relax in the refuge of the inner home. So what that means is that when you go out of home every morning, I don't mean your house, I mean your inner home, you go out to do your duties and your work, you know you've always got a place to come back to, of rest, of peace. This is what we do in the world. I go to Sydney this afternoon, go work over there, but I take my inner home with me. So at any time, if you feel tired or stressed, you can go back into that inner home. It's a marvellous resource. Because you know, sometimes, as those of you who know my life as a monk, sometimes you do a great deal, and sometimes you get very tired, physically. What you do is go into your inner home. You rest there for a while, and when you come out, you can be so bright, so peaceful, and so clear. That's where all the Dhamma comes from the inner home. I remember once that, again, one time when I went to Canberra, to give some talks many years ago. Now Canberra is a very cold and damp place. And of course, not taking all the proper cold weather gear, but not realizing where I was going, not having been there before. After only a couple of days, I got a terrible cold in Canberra. In particular, these people, they insisted on taking me up to this monastery in Bundanoon just for the day. And the people of this monastery insisted on keeping me there until sort of really late, because when I said goodbye, I had to make a whole ceremony of saying goodbye. And so by the time I got back to where I was supposed to give the talk, I hadn't washed, hadn't shaved, had about a quarter of an hour to have a cup of tea, and I was supposed to give a public talk. And I felt absolutely terrible. My eyes were streaming, my nose was always running and sneezing, I was coughing. I had a very bad cold, but I had to give a talk. I remember starting that talk, and it was just absolutely hopeless. I just couldn't keep a train of thought going before I sneezed, and the eyes were watering, and people felt sorry for me. But I said, okay, let's stop the talk and let's meditate for half an hour. So I meditated for half an hour, so I went into my inner home. When I came out afterwards, apparently I gave a really brilliant talk. No, and my nose stopped sneezing, my eyes stopped watering, and I was happy as could be. That's the resource which you have to deal with your life, no matter what's happening. So sometimes I have to deal with bodily stress, even worldly stress as well. And that's my resource, that inner home. So learn that inner home, so when you go into the world, you have a place, a resource, a refuge. You can use that refuge skillfully. I keep encouraging all Buddhists to have a place in their house, if not a room, at least a corner of their house, which is their shrine room, their religious room. I see just sometimes is how big people's bathrooms are. Well, what's that used for? Sometimes it's marble, and sometimes very fancy taps and faucets. They use that to clean up their body. They have these amazing kitchens and lounge rooms and games rooms and play rooms and TV rooms and family rooms and these huge, huge, huge bedrooms with en suites. But very few houses have got a spiritual room. A room which they set aside just for the cultivation of Dhamma or their religion, whichever that is. A spiritual haven in their room. A place where they're not cleaning their body, where they're cleaning their mind. But they're not feeding their stomach, but they're feeding their heart. I find that that's just so necessary in today's world, to have a meditation room, a shrine room, just a place of peace and silence. And if you haven't got one, if you haven't got a room in your house to do that, first of all, ask yourself, do you really need all these other rooms? Are they really that important, an office and all this other stuff? Put the office in the corner of your bedroom. And put your meditation room in your office. What's really more important to you? But if you haven't got the room, at least a corner of some quiet room, a quiet space, where you can put your Buddha statue or your pictures, your Dhamma books, and have that a sacred place in your house, a place where you can go at any time. And after a while of sitting there reading Dhamma books, even chanting there, as I was saying earlier, builds up power, becomes a power spot in your house. A place where you just sit there, because the only thing you ever do there is to meditate, to read Dhamma books, to quieten down. It becomes like psychologically empowered as a place of peace. I've been teaching this for many years, encouraging people to build these places in their house or in the corners of their rooms. And people have told me some amazing stories of what happens when they have these quiet places, whenever they get sort of tight and tense or about to have an argument with their wife or husband. They just retreat into their quiet corner and sit down and meditate for a while. It saves so many marriages and so much pain. And one family once told me that they saw their young daughter and son having an argument and fighting. And I think that his son hit the daughter or something, smacked the one. And instead of smacking him back, she ran up into her mother's bedroom and sat in a sacred spot and meditated for a few minutes. And the parents were so impressed. They never taught her to do this. They never told her to do this. She felt that when she was so disappointed, when she was so afraid, when she was so uptight, that was the place to go. It's marvellous in your family if you can have a place like that. So the people in your family, if it's not yourself, your partner, your children, your friends, will have a place, a refuge, which reminds them of their inner home. But when you have a place like that, to make sure you don't use it for anything else, please respect the sacredness of that area. So you don't use it to, you know, listen to the radio, or to, you know, to listen to CDs, or write books or something. It's a sacred place. It's a place of doing nothing, a place of relaxation. Everywhere else in the world, you have to strive. You have to exert control. You have to do your duties and do your work, which is expected of you in the world. You have to endure sort of silly people telling you to do stupid things. That's fine. When you go to your little corner, there you can be at peace and let go. It's your little monastery, your little refuge, your little vulture's peak in the middle of your house. So that helps enormously. It's a bit of skillful advice. But sometimes we're not even in our house, sometimes we're in our home, in our place of work. And I read recently of one person who did a very skillful means to be able to meditate at work. This particular person couldn't find a place to meditate. And he couldn't sit in his office, because you know what it's like in that world. You're sitting in your office, you're doing nothing. Someone will come up to you and ask for your help. They will not leave you alone, because everyone is busy and they think you're doing nothing, therefore you're free. Not free to be at peace, but free to help them. You're not doing anything, can you give us a hand? I don't realize that doing nothing, meditation, is so important and valuable. People don't respect peace in our society. Their thing is cropping out. That's why busy people tend to make other people busy, simply because they don't respect peacefulness. So, what this man did, very, very skillful. He decided every hour on the hour, he closed his eyes and meditate for 1 minute. If it wasn't exactly on the hour, because it was ending up a telephone conversation or a meeting with a client or something, he just postponed it for another 5 minutes. But in every hour, he'd always meditate for 1 hour, for 1 minute. He'd close his eyes, sit there by his desk, and just be still. Present moment awareness, silence, you get into the breath, that's beautiful. But just have 1 minute of silence and stillness. And it worked so well, because when people passed him by and saw his eyes closed, sitting at his desk, they thought he was thinking about something, or he was, you know, making a decision, or whatever it was. They didn't know what he was doing. It was not that long, so they never bothered him. So he had 1 minute of peace every day at his office. No, sorry, 1 minute of peace every hour in his office at work, and nobody knew what he was up to. And also, he got away with it. Imagine if you go in your office, you sit there cross-legged in a corner, And your boss will come and say, we're not paying you to do that. Get back in the computer and work. But he didn't know that. He just 1 minute of silence on every hour he was at the desk. And what that meant was he was continually resting. So after 59 minutes of hard work, he'll take 1 minute break to collect himself, to be still. And he found that that meant that he had much more mindfulness for the 59 minutes which followed. He got much more done. He was more alert. He could see into the problems quicker. He was actually a much better worker for that 1 minute of silence. So it's valuing these things and finding the skillful means to be able to do these things. Many years ago, when I was in Thailand, I was on a flight from things probably between Ubon and Bangkok, just a domestic flight going from one place to another, and they gave me a copy of the Bangkok Post, and in the feature section there was an article on the Oriental Hotel in Bangkok, which that year was one of the famous hotels. And that year had won this prize for the best hotel in the world. And it got the top prize. And of course the people in Thailand were very, very impressed and pleased, you know, by this great award for one of their hotels. And so all sorts of feature articles were being done about the Oriental Hotel. And this particular feature article interviewed the manager and asked the manager, why did your hotel win this great prize this year? What is your secrets? Give us some of the things which you do to make your hotel so, so good that's won this international prize. And one of the things he said was, every year I send each one of my staff down from the porters and cleaners, you know, to the concierge, to the cooks, I send each of my staff once a year to a monastery for 1 week to meditate. It's not taken off their holidays, it's at the company's expense. And they say, what are you doing that for? Aren't you some sort of fundamentalist Buddhist who wants to convert all your staff? He said, no, it's just basic good management. Because the 1 week they spend in the monastery meditating means they don't take so much sick leave, that they don't get upset at each other, there's no conflicts in the workforce. They're much more sensitive to the needs of our clients, the people who stay in a hotel. They're just more better people, and they're happier people. If you're working in a hotel, you don't want the people working in the hotel to be grumpy all the time. You want to be met with a smile. You want to see happy people. And they work harder as a result. He said it's basic good management to send your workers to a meditation retreat once every year. It's a shame I didn't keep a copy of that article, because you could have photocopied it and given it to your boss and say, next year, can I come to this retreat on company time? Can you pay the $270, please? Because in your interest, it's worthwhile. The point of the story was that he valued the results of meditation in daily life. You could actually see it as the prize his hotel got that year. But you should be able to see it in your greater efficiency, care, sensitivity, in whatever line of work you're in, whether it's abbot work or anagarika work or mother work or husband work or manager work or washing up dishes work, whatever you do. When you have those attitudes, the dishes become more sparkly, they get done quicker, with more happiness. You find you're a more efficient person. So when you understand things this way, you can see the connections between the meditation life and the work life. And sometimes there isn't such a big cut off from one to the other, as if you're a schizophrenic life, now you're a meditator, now you're a frantic worker. You find that you can work more efficiently with a clear, peaceful mind. So it makes meditation valuable, because you realize its value, not just, you know, for enlightenment, but in actually getting through life. It means that you do more of it. One of the things I've been stressing about meditation in this retreat is the happiness of meditation. That it's meant to be fun, it should be fun, and One of the monks was telling me last night the story of Ajahn Mun, which I didn't know. He was saying that from one of the other monks who used to know him very much, spent a lot of time with him, that Ajahn Mun had a great sense of humour. And he laughed a lot. His actually laugh was really a great laugh, an infectious laugh. I never knew that about Ajahn Mun, but it makes a lot of sense, because that's what arahats do. They just laugh a lot. They smile a lot. I know this is a bit cheeky, but sometimes you call them ha-ha-ha-arahats. I'm going to get in trouble for that, but I don't care. So it's lovely actually to hear that story. So happiness being such an important thing in meditation, if you get happiness in meditation early on, you always want to do it. It's not a case that you get up in the morning and say, ugh, I could do my meditation now. Get this out of the way so then you can get to breakfast. You know, just to get your half an hour out every day. As if it's like taking medicine. It's not like that. After a while, if you really understand what meditation is, you just love meditation. You just want to do it. And sometimes you have to get your breakfast out of the way to get to meditation. Or you have to get work out of the way to get to meditation. Or whatever, it's just you love doing it. So when you sit in your chair, or your stool, or your cushion, just the mind leaps towards silence. And the Buddha said that's a great stage on the path of wisdom, on the path to enlightenment. When the mind leaps, jumps to quietness, to stillness, to non-doing. And hopefully that I've conditioned many of you strongly enough that you realize just how beautiful that silence is. So that in moments of your day when you've got nothing to do, instead of trying to fill those gaps up with stupid things, with pointless things, with just mindless distractions, that your mind leaps towards the opportunity for stillness. It jumps at the chance and goes into stillness, steadiness, peace, freedom. And this is a sign of a practitioner, the sign of someone who's on the path, the sign of someone who's got sufficient wisdom. Their mind recognizes what's in its own interest. So in the mornings or the evenings, you just leap towards your meditation cushion. Not as medicinal, not as some sort of punishment, not as some sort of penance. It's something you just want to do. You know when people, why they wouldn't go to church if they were Christians, because it was boring, they didn't like to go there, they didn't leap to the fact it's Sunday, let's go to church today and listen to a good sermon. It became boring and cold, and that's why people dropped away from churches in the West. And people will drop away from meditation cushions. And you will stop meditating unless you get fun out of it. So developing fun in meditation, at home or here, wherever, is a way of continuing that practice. And little by little as you continue the practice in the world, keep it up. Keep it up for the sake of fun, for the sake of peace, for the sake of taste of freedom. For the sake of you've got no other choice, you have to. Some people say, and I understand this very well, it used to be the same when I was a lay person. If you don't meditate for one day, it's like not eating. Your heart feels sick. It's got no strength. You find yourself getting grumpy, getting angry, because it's not got this feed of happiness. It doesn't matter if people say you're just addicted to meditation. Great, be addicted to peace, be addicted to happiness, be addicted to freedom. It's a nice thing to be addicted to. Some people say you should not attach to these things, and they quote the simile of the raft. The Buddha said the raft is just for crossing the stream from one shore to another, but you should not cling on to that raft, they say. But the story actually goes that once you've crossed, then you should not cling on to the raft. But you should not throw the raft away in the middle of the stream. It's what a lot of people do. No wonder they're sick. So attach to this raft. Attach to your meditation. Attach to your precepts. Attach to goodness. You also understood from this retreat the importance of those peace steps, the importance of goodness. In this retreat you get the payoff. One of the payoffs from all the precepts and the goodness and the generosity and the kindness, the selflessness which you've done throughout the year. You get the payoff here. Because the payoff is that beautiful mind. Here you're understanding what this mind is and why we keep precepts. why we are generous, why we give, why we give of ourselves, why we forgive others, or we forgive ourselves. It's all part of dana, all giving. Why we have loving kindness and give people the benefit of the doubt. Give them goodwill. Give them our happiness. Share our merits with others. Why we do this? And we actually see it because it makes this mind so beautiful and pure. You feel it in daily life. You've got something inside of you which you feel very, very proud of. And it's good to feel proud of goodness. In the Mangala Sutta, Puja Pujaniyana, Etam Mangalam Uttama, to worship that which is truly worthy of worship. To praise that which is truly worthy of praise. And goodness is worthy of praise. Good meditation is worthy of praise. That's why when people have a good meditation, praise yourself. Tell yourself how good that is, how wonderful that is. Because then you'll do it again, and again and again and again. The mind feeds on praise, feeds on joy. Use that as a skillful means to encourage you more and more and more. If you even have that word in Buddhism, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Well done, well done, well done. You've heard that so many times. Buddhism is into praise. We're into encouragement. Because it works. So, it's worship, that which is worthy of worship. But don't praise stupid people. You know, don't praise like sports stars who win their cup, or film stars, or whatever else, if somebody wins a war, and all that sort of stuff. That's not praising those people worthy of praise. It's not praising those qualities. You know, you've become a millionaire. That's not worthy of praise. What's worthy of praise? It's a mentally retarded girl who's just given a small flower to the shrine. Somebody has worked so hard on the meditation cushion. First time they've been on a retreat, they've done so well. That's worthy of praise. Someone has just maintained the mind in the present moment just for 1 minute during this whole 9-day retreat for the very first time. That's worthy of praise. So praise that which is really worthy of praise. Pujaye Pujaniyanang. To worship that which is truly worshipful. And then you encourage yourself, you encourage good qualities in the world. It means that meditation does become strong, goodness becomes strong, virtue becomes strong. Not only does it mean that your happiness level rises in life, it also means that when you come to a meditation retreat, it's as if you've done all of the background work. You'll come into this retreat not with an empty hand, with all these great spiritual qualities, this great spiritual wealth, all the goodness which you've done. And as I've explained when talking about the deep meditation, especially the stage of nimittas and jhanas, it means that your mind is so powerful and strong, so beautiful, that nimittas come up earlier than expected. They burst through the breath simply because they're just too powerful to ignore. Sometimes if nimittas don't come, or when they come they're very weak. Sometimes it means that your mind is not pure enough, not strong enough, it's not empowered by goodness, by virtue, by purity, by strength. So when one realizes this, one realizes that one doesn't just keep precepts just to go to heaven. That one cannot just meditate and forget these precepts as just cultural accretions to Buddhism. You don't just keep these precepts because it says so in the scriptures, or the monk says so. You see firsthand one of the reasons why you have to keep these precepts if one has success in meditation. You see it firsthand, you see the connection, and just how keeping, not just keeping precepts, but actually doing the opposite of precepts as well, opposite of killing, is actually helping people, saving people's lives, helping their pain. By looking after them. Compassion is the opposite of killing. The opposite of stealing is generosity. Not taking from others, giving to others. And the opposite of adultery is this like faithful commitment, keeping promises. The opposite of lying, sometimes it's said bad speech, is good speech, being kindly to each other. Never saying a word you'd never like to hear yourself praising. And lastly, the opposite of taking alcohol and drugs, which cloud the mind, is practicing things like meditation, which clear the mind, developing mindfulness. So for each one of those five precepts is the opposite. So our practice of virtue is not just not doing that which is bad. It's putting forth effort and doing that which is good. It's an active aspect of our lives. We go and serve the community. We look after the Buddhist society or the monasteries. Or we go and do some social work. We look after our community, our parents, or the elderly, whatever. We have to go out there and do something. Rather than thinking, look at me, I'm so good, I don't kill, I don't steal, I don't commit adultery because I'm not married, and I don't take alcohol and drugs, and don't lie because I never speak to anybody, I stay in my little home all by myself, all day, all night. So that's not good enough, is it really? It's actually serving and doing as well, because that gives you the power of your mind, giving. Yeah, those of you who've known me for a long time know just how busy which I have been, especially the first years of building our monastery in certain time. That really was hard work. All day, from early in the morning till late at night. And then just washing in the cold lake, in the wind, you had a chill factor as well. And used to work, and hardly slept at night because sleeping outside, and the wind would wake you up at midnight. And you'd be awake for the rest of the evening. And we used to go on Friday evenings to our small centre, which was then in North Perth. I used to look forward to that so much. First of all, to have a hot shower for the first time in the week, wash all the dirt of work away from you. And then to have a proper sleep and catch up. It was hard work in those days. And sometimes I thought I was really sacrificing my meditation. I thought that, working that hard and having no time for oneself, whenever you got back in the evening, you just crashed out. You just woke up in the morning, putting yourself out of bed for another day's work. It was so hard. But I thought I was getting nowhere. But the surprise came when you just had a week off. And when you sat down to meditate, it was straight back there again. Beautiful nimittas, beautiful meditations. And I couldn't really believe it at first. What's going on? I haven't been meditating for weeks, for months. Not really continuous, been trying, but getting very sleepy. As soon as you had the time, it was right back there again. And of course, at the time, I didn't really understand why. Why was it so easy to meditate after just such a long time of hard work? And of course, it's because I've been building up the virtue, the power of the mind. I was being selfless, giving myself to what's one of the great acts of good karma in the world, building a monastery. Huge act of good karma. And I was actually helping there and giving. Didn't realize at the time, but I was making huge amounts of good karma. So when I stopped, that beautiful mind was right there and just burst into my consciousness. I realized, and as I realized many times, you don't lose anything by giving to others. It's not as if you lose your energies, but you gain more energies. That's why that sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you worked so hard on this retreat and gave 2 talks a day and all these interviews. And if you count up how many hours, which I did, it's quite a lot of hours of actually work. Probably even in the workforce you wouldn't do as much work as this. Nevertheless, you get so much happiness out of this. Because you get happiness out of it because it's good karma. Whenever you do stop, you get beautiful mind states. So I love doing these retreats. They're my holiday. Because you get beautiful meditation. You've got the opportunity to brighten up your mind by giving even more. So don't make too much of a distinction between meditation retreats and the life outside. Make the life outside a support for meditation. Keep your precepts, but also do good things as well. Do your service to the community. Those of you who are working on this WASAT, which we're doing, it's going to wear you out. You sometimes get so tired and frustrated. So hard just making the ceremony, arranging everything. But afterwards, the night when you go home or the following day, just sit down and close your eyes. Just start washing the breath and you find these beautiful mind states come up. the purity, the inspiration. Is it, wow, this is so nice. Where did that come from? All that selflessness, all that giving, all that pure-heartedness. The Buddha said, Sila pari bhavito samadhi mahaparo hoti mahani sangso. I remember that because that's what we chant at the ordination ceremony of monks. That's what I chant, the upajara, the precept I have to chant in monks' ordination. He's saying is that samadhi, meditation, when it's empowered, accompanied by virtue, is a great fruit, a great benefit. This is samadhi, meditation, is accompanied by the virtue. It's a great fruit, a great benefit. You can understand that very clearly, and I've explained it to you. And the virtue is behind your meditation. My goodness, it's strong. And then it continues on in this little chant. Samadhi paribhavita panya mahapala hoti mahani sangsa. Wisdom, when it's empowered and accompanied by samadhi, is a great benefit, a great wisdom. A great benefit, a great fruit. As I was saying, when wisdom comes from samadhi, it's empowered by it, it's a great fruit, a great benefit, basically, enlightenment wisdom. But they did make the last, panya paribhavito, no, I've got it now. No, it's another say that from the wisdom, I think it's practice which is empowered by wisdom, leads to the destruction of these outflowings. The wisdom leads to the destruction of these outflowings of mind, the defilements of sensory desire, of being, of ignorance, delusion. Therefore, you monk, you should practice virtue, make it complete. You should practice meditation, make it complete. You should practice wisdom, make it complete, for the sake of enlightenment. But certainly you can see how virtue supports samadhi. So when you're out there in the world, you can practice meditation by practicing its supports, by making sure that you're virtuous and good. That's how you take what you've learned here back out into the world. And there's always occasions when you can practice virtue. There's always someone in the office or at home, someone you meet, who will need your time, who you can care for. And don't think that you are neglecting your meditation. What you're doing is building the supports for meditation, building the supports for freedom, building the supports for nirvana. The Buddha said to even the monks, you should not neglect to make merit, to make punya. Even you monks should make punya, merit. When I heard that, I was astounded. I thought at that time that merit was just what lay people did. That's traditional Buddhism, going to the temples, offering dana, taking the five precepts, doing this chanting. I thought that's just lay people's stuff. But no, that's monk stuff as well. Everybody's stuff. What it's doing is empowering the mind. You find the fruits of it when you do the meditation. And also that you see the big picture on a retreat such as this. Just how all this meditation, all this virtue leads to wisdom, to insight, and how that leads to real freedom. The freedom from defilements, the freedom from the asavas, the freedom from rebirth, the end of samsara. And whether you're a monk or a lay person, that once you see the real problem, you see what's really happening, you see where truth and happiness and freedom really lie, there comes a time when you can't really forget these teachings. You can't really throw them away. You may move us away from a Buddhist society and go back in there into the world and forget all these things you think, but you can't really forget them. They keep coming back up and again and again and again. As one person once said some years ago, when they came to the Buddhist society in the early days and they went interstate or somewhere and never practiced for about 3 or 4 years, and they came back again and they said, you know, even though I tried, I can't forget these teachings. You can't put them aside. What's happening there is that these are calling on a recognition of truth inside of you, a recognition of real happiness in the path of freedom. It's happened to me, it's happened to many of you. You taste something in your meditation which seems so pure, which promises that freedom, You may not be able to put your finger on it and explain it to yourself all that well, but it's real, it's there. Remember the first time I meditated? It's amazing, just the first time, only for about 10 minutes, it etched into my memory forever. It was in the Wordsworth room of King's College in Cambridge. I can even recall the room right now. The first time that I went to do some meditation, only 5 or 10 minutes. Even though you never got into jhanas or anything like that, it just felt good. It felt peaceful. And from that moment on, I was hooked. Strange. Just how does a moment of peace just ring so many bells inside of us, which shows us that this, hang on, this is the way to peace. It's the purest thing which I've ever seen. This is real freedom. It's a taste of freedom, as the Buddha kept on saying. When you can taste that freedom, even just a small taste of it, remains in one's mind forever. One has to develop that, to cultivate it, until one doesn't just get the taste, one gets the whole meal. And the meal does its job, filling the pack of wisdom and giving full and true liberation. So each one of us, whether we're a monk, layperson, whatever, we're all on that path to Nibbana. We've already gone too far to stop. You've tasted some meditation, it's too late. You've tasted something which is far exceeds the taste, the power, the bliss, the freedom of anything else in the world. The mind will incline to that, sometimes in fits and starts, but it has to go back there. You go back and back and back, revisiting, sometimes getting lost, not finding the way back there. But it won't be able to give up the struggle, the task. It will be inclining towards Nibbana. And it will change your lifestyle little by little. You change your lifestyle to fit into the path of Nibbana. Virtue becomes such a joy, so much that you can't find enough opportunities to help, to do generous work. And it looks upon as being a privilege, not a chore. If you join the Buddhist Society Committee, it is a privilege, not a chore. Help at Waysack, thank you for asking me. It's so wonderful to be able to do this for somebody else. You do virtue and good acts, generosity, because it's such a wonderful thing to do. In Buddhism they say sometimes stream winners have got to be looked after by the Sangha. There's a case of this one family, supposed to be stream winners, who would always give so much to the Sangha when they came on alms round. They were quite poor and they didn't have much to eat themselves. And the lay people came along and started criticizing. And monks, it's good that you receive these things, but those people haven't got enough to eat themselves. So the Buddha had to call a meeting and lay down a rule. In such situations, the Sangha can agree. In special circumstances, you're not allowed to accept so much from that family. Have compassion for them. Because sometimes it gets like that, when you get that much streaming of faith, it's much better to give your food to somebody else, to the Sangha, than eat it yourself. It's much better to go hungry. Please, take it. I get so much more happiness, I can eat any paper. I want to make more merit. Please, give me a chance to make more merit. Please, 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 please. And so the monks have to say, now hold on. The Buddha said, it comes from the top. We can't do this. So if it comes from the top, they can't argue about that. So sometimes that's what happens when we really understand what these things are. Sometimes you've got to restrain people. Unfortunately, mostly in the world you have to encourage them all the time. There's not enough stream winners, that's why. But there's some people you can actually, and you know those people. They would give anything. They could have shut off their own back, the food in their pantry, sometimes they give their life. Those people may get poor, but they're nimittas. They're just something to behold. Wow. And who cares about being hungry when you've got beautiful nimittas? Wow. That's really nice. That's that purity. And this is actually the inspirational merit making. And we need to be inspired like that when we get into jhanas. Don't be afraid of those emotions, the inspirational emotions. If you do have the chance to go to places like India, the holy places, or some of the old monasteries in Sri Lanka or Burma or Thailand, you really get into it. If you go to those places, get your money's worth. Get in there and cry your eyes out. Get really inspired. Imagine the Buddha sitting there. Imagine Ajahn Chah teaching the monks in the forest in the early days. Just allow the piti, the joy and energy just to come up through the whole body, course right through you. You get so inspired. People don't know how to indulge these days. Indulge in the positive emotions of inspiration, joy, faith. They're called powers, indriyas, controlling faculties. That's what really makes the meditation buzz along. It's a fast path to enlightenment. So you go to those places and get joy, get inspiration. When you read the suttas or you chant, just chant with your heart, not your mouth. Don't worry about what it sounds like outside. Be concerned what it sounds like inside, where it's coming from. It's great to be able to chant, understand the meaning. You get so high, so beautifully high, and that's a pure emotion. So they're out there in the world. Develop the pure emotions of inspiration. It's only good. It leads to nibbana. So these are some practices which you can take out there in the world. You can do it any old time. In particular, there's so much opportunity to do those first two stages of meditation. Present moment awareness and silence. When you're working at your desk, present moment awareness, work silently. You get so much more done. When you're driving your car, turn the radio off, turn the CD off. Don't even listen to a talk of Ajahn Brahm. Listen to the silence. Because all you're hearing is Ajahn Brahm telling you to be quiet, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet. So anyone who really realises, oh, that's right, just turn it off. So there's so many opportunities in life. Especially to practice that mindfulness of silence, of present moment awareness. So many times, opportunities in the day to let go of control. Even if you're late for work, sometimes you just can't do anything about it. Sometimes it's a traffic jam. Just worrying about it doesn't get you any faster. So see if you can learn how to just be at peace in the world, to put these things in practice, to practice non-controlling, letting go. Because there are many opportunities in life, many times there's nothing you can do. There's no way you can get the aircraft to move faster, because you're late. You can't go up to the captain, can you? Where's Ari? He's the captain of... Where's he gone? Oh, I can't see him here. Back. Where's Ari? Oh, there he is. Sorry, yeah, right in front of me. Isn't that amazing? Whenever you look for something, you look for anywhere except right in front of you. That's like looking for jhanas. Look for jhanas anywhere except right in front of you. You look for peace anywhere except right here and right now. So thank you for giving me the opportunity for another metaphor. But Ari is a captain. Has anybody ever come to your cabin and say, can you get there faster today because I'm late? Because they're smart, that's why. It's mostly because of security these days. But you see that I give you $100 if you can get there 5 minutes ahead of schedule. You can't do that in life. That's why you've got to let go. And we all have to learn how to let go of some things in life. And so you might as well start now. When you learn how to let go a lot in this meditation retreat, you go outside and you've got that skill of letting go of things you can't control. You've done it all retreat and now you can do it. So that really helps you in that world outside. Things you can't do anything about, you just let go. Your husband, your wife, you can't do anything about them, let them go. Children, messing around, can't do much about them, let them go. You know the skills of letting go. With children, we always give the simile of that, the water buffalo. It's like a husband or a wife sometimes. This is in Thailand, this man was taking the water buffalo out to the fields to graze. The water buffalo got excited and ran off. And this man tried to stop him. Try to stop a water buffalo. Imagine how big a water buffalo is. Huge. And this was like a small Thai farmer. He held on to the rope twisted around his finger and pulled his finger off. So he came into the monastery. It's like Jacko was the abbot, I was number two, and just half a finger. And there's obviously blood everywhere and quite a bit of pain. So Ajahn Jacko took him to the hospital and got him patched up. But there's a great metaphor he gave us. He's okay afterwards. There's a great metaphor he gave us. Water buffaloes, you're stupid trying to stop a water buffalo. It just pulls your fingers off. Your husband, your wife, your children. Sometimes your mind is like a water buffalo. And if you try and stop it, what happens? Just pull some of you off and you get a lot of pain and suffering. And what happens if you do let the water buffalo go? If you let go? The water buffalo only just runs about half a kilometre or a kilometre down the road. It doesn't go that far. And then it stops and settles itself down. And then there's a farmer just walks gently afterwards and pulls it back again. When it's stopped, when it's easy to control. That's all you need to do with husbands and wives and kids. They run off, and then they stop, then you can pull them in. As with your mind, you know when to let go. Sometimes your mind is like that, in meditation. It's running off, fantasies, thoughts. Let it go. Don't let it pull your finger off. And then once it's gone a little way down the road, when it stops, it's had its little bit of fun. Okay, now come back, bed please. So that's actually a nice simile there for your life. You're learning how to let go. If you do that with your mind, you can do that with other things in life. You become a much more peaceful person and a much more efficient manager. A manager of your husband, a manager of your wife, a manager of your kids, a manager of your accounts, a manager of your life. So I often say that meditation is like a microcosm of the real world. If you know how to meditate, you know how to live. If you know how to let go and be at peace, you know everything you need to know about living the world. So you can live a very happy life, a very beautiful life. If you want to take it that one step further and become enlightened, you know how to do it. Same process, only intensified. So that's what you do out there in the world. Don't think there's going to be too much of a transition. It's going to be outside, it's going to be a jolt to the system. But eventually you'll learn how to adapt. You can be at peace among the peaceful. You can work amongst the people who are working. You can laugh with those who are laughing. You can be sympathetic for those who are crying. You have all the resources to help and serve in the world. I've already mentioned at the beginning of this retreat, there's no difference between vipassana and samatha. You know, two types of meditation. There's no difference between the bodhisattva way and the arahat way. All these differences which people make are because they don't really understand. The best thing you can do for the whole world, the best gift you can give for others is to become enlightened. So you have huge compassion, huge resources of wisdom to share with others. And you become enlightened for the sake of others. For the sake of others, you become enlightened. There's no difference between those ways. People make all these differences. So go out there in the world, for the sake of others, become enlightened. Become enlightened for the sake of others. That's the path and that's the way. And if you haven't got your paycheck yet, don't worry, it is coming. Sometimes Saturdays, the moment doesn't work. So just leave your address, sometime it will come. We'll send it on to you. So I hope you've had a very lovely retreat. It's still a few hours to go, so just be alert, the postman might be knocking soon. Any questions or comments so far? I should actually say just what's happening this afternoon. I think it's on the board there. After lunch, free time as usual, 2 o'clock, if everyone can come in to this hall for the final little bit of sitting, a bit of metta meditation, sharing of merits, and final blessing, and we finish off just before 3 o'clock. So please no photos, because I've got to rush off to the airport. Keep the photos in your heart, those memories which chemicals can never erase. So the photos inside of you. If anyone needs to say anything beforehand, please make sure it's done before 3 o'clock, just lunchtime or whatever, because 3 o'clock I won't be able to linger on. Okay, is that quite clear about this afternoon's program? Okay, any questions before we finish off? Yeah? Best way to make merit is keeping precepts. Better than that is meditating. Whatever is a path towards nirvana, whatever is a way of sharing, letting go, abandoning, relinquishing, that's how to make merit. And you feel it in your heart. But this is a good thing to do. It's letting go of some selfishness, some attachments. You feel that. I remember as a student, every act of generosity which I did as a student, best money I've ever spent. And this was a Tibetan nun came once to give a talk at our Buddhist society in Cambridge. And she didn't talk about Dhamma at all. It wasn't sort of high Dhamma about non-self and those sorts of stuff. She was just helping an orphanage in some northern part of Nepal somewhere. She was just a soft, loving person. And I got so inspired that I went to my bank the following day and got £10, which was 2 weeks' food money for me. I didn't starve, but I went hungry those 2 weeks. So I could send it off to an orphanage in northern Nepal, Sikkim or something, I forget where it was. It was in Sikkim, that's right. I know, I just get so much joy from that. Still do. Every act of kindness and generosity like that, you never, ever forget. It's the best way to spend money. You could go and spend that on sort of going to a party or getting a new pair of velvet trousers or whatever. You know what you do with a young man? That's stupid. They wear out. But an act of kindness never wears out. It's with you for the whole of your life. An act of like compassion. You go and give to somebody. You know, they need your help, your time. You've been so busy, you just got home from work and your friend is in need, they've got some terrible thing happened to them today. And you're so exhausted. Go to them. Give them your time. And you'll never ever regret it. Ever. Yeah?
Did you attain any chance as a lay person or novice?
Novice. I know you're very sneaky, Angie. because you know that I'm not allowed to say about jhanas as a monk or other attainments, but as a layperson, I'm not sure if you're allowed to say that or not, whether that's against the rule. You're not allowed to, isn't it? Okay. So I'll keep it vague. I have very good meditation as a layperson.
You encourage us to get
jhanas. Yeah, well, it is possible to get jhanas as a lay person, yes.
Yes, I just wondered
whether
you did it when you were
a kid. I can't say. I can't say. But there is I give as many hints as I possibly can. I can't say. But there are some experiences I had as a lay person which were so strong and powerful they led me to becoming a monk. And this is why I sometimes say, if you have, you know, really, really good meditation, sometimes you can't put it down, you can't forget it. If you have the opportunity, like I was free, I didn't have a wife or kids or anything like that. And I was very lucky at the age of, you know, 20, 21, 22, 23. You hadn't really got attached in the world yet. You hadn't put down your roots in that world. So having those experiences and having that freedom at the time, it's great calm to be able to go in the monastery and just find out that's what you always wanted to do in life. And that's the way to really get those meditation. They were practicing that, they were encouraging that, they were explaining that. So finding out what this were and what it meant. And now for years and years you find that that's actually an important ingredient on the path to nirvana. Oh, that gives you so much inspiration. You find out that's what the Buddha was up to all the time. Oh, that's beautiful. So I was very fortunate that way, to be able to get into the monastery before a lady got me. Very nice guy. That could go at times, so that's a bit. So is it in the other? I've got nothing against ladies and women. It's the same as like ladies and women with men. I mean, Sister Wayama, I'm very lucky to be able to have got into a monastery before she got into a relationship with a man. The same with Julie and Elizabeth. Because sometimes it's, you know, you get into these relations, sometimes they can be quite liberating, but sometimes you have to wait for years before you're free to practice. And I know a lot of people who would jump at the chance of going to a monastery, becoming a monk or a nun, but they've got children, and they get a husband, and they've got a wife, they've got responsibilities, they've got a mortgage to pay off, or whatever. So it's really amazing, a good fortune in this life that I was free to do that. But that was one of the main motivating forces, the meditation. It's not so much theory, but theory was good as well, but the experiences of these things are much more powerful than all the words. Okay, so I think that's probably enough for now. We've got another couple of hours before lunch meditation, and then afterwards more meditation. Remember this, treat every moment of this retreat not as the last moment, but just as an ordinary moment. The last moment is not until 1 second before 3 p.m. All the other moments are just now. So get your money's worth. It's just like sort of having a beautiful meal. You just, the last crumb, you paid for this. Make the most of it. The last crumb of this retreat, just enjoy. Savor every moment. So even though that in one way that we're getting close to the end of the retreat, it's still thousands of seconds away from here. So enjoy every second and don't think about the end of the retreat until it actually comes. So please enjoy, have a nice meditation, do walking meditation, the rain will stop, it's beautiful out there. Because this opportunity will soon be gone from you, and you'll be back in your home, in your work. So make the most of it while it's still here. Okay.